to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the Wintry Mix podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on January the 5th, 2016. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
Happy New Year, Frank. Miss talking with you.
Yes, you too, Nick. It's great to be back.
This week on TWiL, we are pleased to greet the wonderful Mary Crossley. Professor Crossley is professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. Her scholarship has focused on issues of inequality in the financing and delivery of healthcare, encompassing topics ranging from potential legal remedies for physician bias to an examination of recent trends in health insurance coverage and their tendency to discriminate against the unhealthy, and so on and so forth. In 2013, she was selected as a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Public Health Law Scholar in Residence. She's currently serving as a faculty mentor for that great Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Public Health Law Education faculty program. Welcome, Mary.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
Not only did TWiL go dark for a couple of weeks over the holidays, but health law and policy has been relatively quiet too. Notwithstanding, I did find some important stories kind of sitting around on the desk that we should quickly address in today's lightning round. So, Frank, over to you.
And I wanted to start out with a story that was in the New York Times, in the Upshot by Margo Sanger Katz, titled Even Insured Can Face Crushing Medical Debt. And this is a study that was based on a poll that was undertaken by the Times and the Kaiser Family Foundation, which found that about 20% of people under 65 with health insurance had problems paying their medical bills over the past year, and 53% of those without insurance said the same. And, you know, as they drill down into the details of this study, it is a very interesting portrait of financial distress among Americans. One thing just sort of indicating, if you look at, you know, the average amount of money that people are paying for housing, for utilities, for childcare, for food, there's just not that much money left over for healthcare. And a lot of people are trying to sort of save money around the edges, particularly, say, if they're on exchange plans, getting the lower precious metal tiers. So they pay a lower premium, but then they're responsible for higher cost sharing thanks to the lower actuarial value of the plan. And now some of these folks are getting caught up in unexpected co-insurances, big deductibles, etc. And I think that studies like these have the potential to change the narrative on Obamacare. I think we've seen a lot of triumphalism towards the end of last year by folks like Peter Orszag and those in the aligned with the president, pointing to the higher rate of insurance. But if it turns out that this is coincident with a higher rate of risk for people with the new insurance, that's going to raise a lot of concerns about, for example, the hollowing out of health insurance. So it does raise some real important worries.
And I think causes us to need to fix some of our rhetoric and stop talking about just the uninsured and talk more and more about the underinsured. And I think it's interesting, Frank, that similar kind of research is suggesting that idea you have of just how much money there is to go around in a family budget. That also seems to be influencing folks in choosing the penalties for the individual mandate rather than getting coverage.
That's absolutely right.
The next story I wanted to bring up is it's a series of stories, actually, and very impressive work by Charlie Ornstein and Annie Waldman and others at ProPublica. And I think they also did this in conjunction with NPR. They did some FOI requests on HIPAA complaints and analyzed the complaint patterns, particularly with regard to sort of repeat offenders, looking to see exactly what had been done with regard to them. And the number of repeat offenders who apparently don't seem to receive anything other than a stern letter saying that they have been naughty. I think it's an important piece and well worth reading for HIPAA folks, but I think it's also going to be potentially very important for policymakers, because what they're doing is they're actually continuing to collect this data and they put it into a searchable database. It really could turn out to be a most valuable tool in trying to figure out what to do, at least in the sort of conventional healthcare world where we still have some privacy work to do.
totally agreed there, Nick. And I find the work of the ProPublica team, starting with Julia Angwin on privacy in general, and then Charlie Ornstein's just amazing stories, to be really inspiring in terms of raising awareness about some of these problems. Now, I guess it's back over to me, and to segue into another privacy matter, there is a fascinating final rule that was issued by OCR at HHS very recently that was on the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. That's the system that essentially is maintained by the FBI to conduct background checks. And the new final rule essentially is designed to expressly permit certain HIPAA-covered entities to disclose to this NICS background check system the identities of people who are subject to what's called a federal mental health prohibitor that would disqualify them from having a firearm or shipping it or doing other things related to firearms. And it's just a fascinating glimpse into the intricacies of federal privacy law, some of the conflicts that are involved. I'm also looking forward to seeing some commentary on this from, say, a constitutional privacy angle, because there are some cases out there involving law enforcement officials trying to sort of do blanket surveillance of, say, mothers that might have children with drug problems and investigating them. And there's constitutional concerns raised in a Charleston case, I believe that is. I'll be sure to put that on the show notes. And I think that this this issue of the surveillance and public health surveillance with respect to gun owners is a sleeper, but is certainly going to be in the news quite a bit more, what with Obama's executive actions and this new effort to sort of expressly speed up some information sharing in the area.
Yes, and as you probably know, the APRM on this came out, I think, more than a year ago. And a good friend of the show, David Pittman at Politico, has been chasing this story for a while. The actual reg that came out, I guess it was yesterday, for you HIPAA geeks, it will be codified as 164.512K7. It's actually pretty narrow and I think is designed to allay some of the fears, Frank, that maybe you raise by severely cabining some of this collection. But all things gun, of course, are incredibly controversial, and I'm sure we won't have heard the last of this. One final quick one, again, for the geeks. There was a statute, an act, the Patient Access and Medicare Protection Act, I don't know what we're going to end up talking about, calling it. We've given up on acronyms, haven't we? It's a relatively short piece, but what it does have in it, and the president's already signed this, is it has more sort of hardship exceptions and processes for the Meaningful Use Program for the 2015 reporting period. It's a case-by-case determination. Goodness knows how it's going to play out in practice. But I'm wondering whether Meaningful Use is sort of becoming a sort of an Affordable Care Act mini-me. Although it's a relatively small provision in the great scheme of things, I think that Congress is sort of applying a similar kind of approach to Meaningful Use, which is death by a thousand paper cuts as we have delays and tweaks and so on. And I guess we won't really know the future of Meaningful Use, if it has a future, until after the election.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And just a shout out to our Christmas shows for pointing out the author of one of the most, I think, devastating subterranean strategies against the ACA, Marco Rubio inserting language that really cut down on the reinsurance for plans on the exchanges. Wonderful to hear that surfaced back in the Christmas show. And I really like your angle here, Nick, about talking about the ways in which Meaningful Use could sort of suffer a death by a thousand cuts.
Although I do have to point out there is a counter-narrative about the Rubio insertion, if I may use that term. And I did read somewhere that maybe he was taking a little too much credit for how that all went down. So I think maybe not only do we have a death by thousand cuts, but we also have opportunism thrown into the mix. But let us move on and let us formally welcome Mary to our conversation. And Mary's been doing a lot of work with regard to community health needs assessment. CHENA, as I think we've agreed to refer to the CHNA, particularly the ACA provisions and the IRS regulations, which I guess are coming up for about a one-year anniversary. So Mary, in some of your work that I've read, you characterize the history of the standard applied to 501c3 providers as evolving from a charity care standard to a community benefit standard. But the ACA and now these IRS regs have added considerable specificity. Before we get into the ugly detail here, can you introduce us to the topic and give the listeners a sense of some of the key issues they need to understand as we continue our conversation?
Sure. So the point to start is that this is all, on some level, tax law. These are rules that are being developed and administered by the IRS. And I perhaps was one of the few people in the country who were particularly enthralled by the Supreme Court's dissing the IRS in King versus Burwell, the majority, Chief Justice Roberts, deciding that the IRS don't know nothing about healthcare policy, and in his decision not to give Chevron deference to the IRS regs regarding the tax credits. Nonetheless, the IRS does have a long history of administering the provisions for hospital tax exemption. And as you suggest, it's a more than the community benefit standard now has been around for nearly 50 years. It came from a revenue ruling in 1969 that was developed by the IRS, apparently in response to concerns by hospitals following the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid, that under the pre-existing charity care standard, there weren't going to be enough people who needed charity care anymore following the passage of Medicare and Medicaid for hospitals to be able to satisfy the requirements of tax exemption. So the large majority, as most of the listeners know, of hospitals in the United States are private, not-for-profit hospitals, which can achieve tax exemption from federal taxation under 501c3 if they qualify as charitable organizations. And the IRS has gone from having a charity care perspective that originally required hospitals to provide care for those who could not pay to the extent of the hospital's financial ability, to a community benefit standard, which stayed in place without much concrete direction from the IRS as to what was required to satisfy it for nearly 50 years. And then in 2010, the ACA in Section 9007 of the ACA, which is codified as Section 501R of the Internal Revenue Code, came up with additional requirements for tax-exempt hospitals. So these are requirements that apply only to hospitals who are seeking or to achieve or retain tax-exempt status. And one of those is the obligation of hospitals to conduct a community health needs assessment at least once every 3 years and to take certain steps in furtherance of that community health needs assessment. So the way I like to think of what Section 501R does is that it reorients, in large part, the hospital's understanding of who their community is. They've been subject to this community benefit standard for nearly 50 years, but they've satisfied it primarily by serving individual patients. The CHNA requirement says, hospitals, you need to look at the needs of your communities as a community and respond to those needs as part of the quid pro quo for all the benefits you get from tax exemption.
Thank you so much, Mary. That's a really great precis of the developments in law here. And one thing I'm wondering about in terms of this transition from an individualistic to a more holistic approach and, say, a communitarian approach, is to what extent is this type of transition related to the health disparities concerns within the ACA? I imagine that when we have only an individualistic orientation, we could see hospitals saying that they're benefiting the community without benefiting, say, some groups within the community. Is there a hope that under the China type of approach that the disparities will be a particular concern and a particular focus of the community needs assessment?
Well, Frank, that's my hope, although it's and I think it is also the hope of many public health researchers. Certainly, most of the discussion regarding the CHNA requirement has cast it primarily or characterized it primarily as incorporation of a more public health or population health perspective into the hospital's obligation for tax exemption. And I think that's accurate. There has been less attention paid, at least in the legal literature to date, to the possibility that it might also play an important role in addressing health disparities. Of course, the two are opposite sides of the same coin. But to date, hospitals have not, I don't believe, focused as clearly on how the community health needs assessment and the steps that follow the assessment might actually provide them with some opportunities to address particular disparities in their communities.
Got it. And just to follow up a bit, one of the things that I have noticed, I went to a talk by J. Philip Thompson that was entitled The Fight for Healthy Cities, The Political and Economic Path to System Change. And he focused on hospitals in Brooklyn that were trying to essentially raise the overall health profile of those in the community. And one of the things they would try to do is, you know, instead of having people come in continually to see a pulmonologist, send out someone to the apartment and see if it was a moldy apartment or if they was totally dusty or there were other sort of determinants of health, the social determinants of health that were driving things. We also had Jessica Mantel on the show last year discussing integrated community health centers as a vision for future change here. Are there sort of concrete ways in which the funding can be shifted? And are there folks resisting? Because one of the things that I noticed in this great New Yorker article by Atul Gawande about this Camden ACO, Accountable Care Organization that was based in Medicaid, was that they were trying to essentially shift funds to get hospital frequent flyers to see social workers and medical legal partnerships and other things so that they didn't have to say go to the same 10 specialists 10 times a year, etc. But they found that actually the specialists were resisting and were saying, hey, you really need to see me every month or something like that. And so I'm wondering if, and I know that's a very broad set of questions, but if there's anything in that set of commentary, you know, do you sense that there are concrete measures that are happening? And also, do you sense if there are any resistance going on right now?
Well, to take the easier part first, I think there is definitely resistance going on now because from the hospital's perspective, this is a new requirement that they are being subjected to that requires them to do things they really are not accustomed to doing. The community health needs assessment is a tool that public health departments are used to implementing, but hospitals really, for the most part, are not, at least in most states. There are about a dozen states that had some kind of state-level community needs assessment requirement for hospitals, but most hospitals really don't have any background in this area. So they're being asked to do something new. They're not being given additional funding or tools to do it. And it's not clear that they particularly are reaping the benefits of what they find as needs in their community that they then address. In some senses, a cynic might say that, in fact, they're being asked to put themselves out of business, to fill fewer of their beds, and under traditional reimbursement mechanisms, that means less hospital revenue. So I think the key question is looking at questions both of how hospitals are reimbursed, as well as budgetary flexibility in terms of what public funds can be used for to support community projects. One of the existing mechanisms that a number of commentators have identified as creating some financial incentive for hospitals to carry out the CHNA and to work with community organizations in ways similar to the ones that you were describing going on in Brooklyn, is the Medicare readmissions penalties. So certainly to the extent that hospitals can avoid losing some of their Medicare reimbursement by working with community organizations or community health workers, helping plan post-discharge connections to social services and other supports for their patients, they may in fact save money by promoting the health of their communities. Beyond that, it's not so clear how hospitals actually benefit directly. I will say, though, that even before the CHNA requirement of the ACA went into effect, the American Hospital Association had already put out a series of reports to its members talking about the importance of focusing on population health. And the main point of the American Hospital Association, the AHA, pointed to the fact that it could see the writing on the wall, that the future of reimbursement was going to be reimbursement based on quality and value, so that hospitals that wanted to be prepared for the new reimbursement mechanisms or new reimbursement schemes needed to start paying attention to population health right now. I think that some of the innovation that's going on at CMS and their Centers for Innovation are trying to, as they develop new reimbursement mechanisms, trying to develop ones that will help support hospitals that want to engage in cross-sector collaborations. I think that some states as well, I believe Maryland has funds that will fund hospital initiatives of this sort. So there's certainly efforts underway. Whether there are clear pathways forward, I don't think that's the case quite yet.
I do like the way that you brought in the readmissions stuff, Mary. I think one of the things we've noticed in health quality is that until those financial sticks actually seem to have some impact, you know, with regard to never events and readmissions, then we didn't really see much progress. Although even with the limited progress we're seeing, we also have a sort of a backstory of continual gaming by providers, such as using observation rather than admission status and so on to avoid penalties. Even the geeky meaningful use issue we discussed at the top of the show, underneath that, there is real provider nervousness that they are going to face reimbursement reductions because of their inability or unwillingness to fully embrace HIT. I want to shift the discussion slightly, however, to sort of the form of the regulations and the messages being sent out by the IRS. In a recent article, you urged the IRS to, quote, seize the opportunity by refining its regulatory framework for the CHNA requirement in order to more robustly promote transparency, accountability, community engagement, and collaboration, while simultaneously leaving hospitals some degree of flexibility. Is it fair to say that the IRS regulations aren't particularly prescriptive, relying instead on process?
I think that's accurate. I would suggest that the IRS regulations that came out in December of 2014 aren't even terribly prescriptive with respect to process, with respect to many elements of the CHNA process. So there are some parts of the regulations that are specific that hospitals have to do certain things, but there are many points at which the regulations give hospitals a great deal of discretion and a great deal of leeway in how they go about, how they identify significant health needs, how they prioritize significant health needs, and then how they choose how to try to respond to those needs. So I think that given the diversity and the heterogeneity of hospitals, I think that a process-focused approach makes sense. I don't think that it makes any sense for the IRS to try to come up with a very prescriptive approach as to what all hospitals must do. That said, I think that even a process-focused approach can give clearer and more directed guidance, while still giving hospitals the kind of flexibility they need to take into account their own circumstances.
Do you think the end game is going to depend on outcomes that that we really won't make much progress here until we agree on some kind of metrics so we can sort of look at what the providers are doing under these regs and similar regs?
Nick, I think one of the problems at this point in focusing on outcomes metrics is that starting there is starting too far down the page, because I think, and this is one of the points that I make in my article, is I think it's really important up front to focus right now as hospitals are starting this process. They're learning a new skill, so to speak. And I think the IRS has the opportunity to wield some of its authority to guide them in how they conduct these CHINAs. And I think that key elements really do depend on greater transparency and accountability, because one of the problems is that there's not clarity right now as to what the metrics should even be, or how the metrics, the measurement that feeds into the metrics, can be conducted. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. There are many public health researchers who are engaged in the process of trying to make some sense as to what sorts of community interventions actually move the needle when it comes to improving community health, because that's not clear at this point, although there is a growing evidence base as to the types of interventions that can help. At this point, I think it makes sense for the IRS to take an approach that encourages hospitals to do something and to be very transparent and to report clearly what it is they are doing, so that we can develop a stronger evidence base for determining what works. And at that point, I think that it would make sense for the IRS or other regulators to become more prescriptive about expecting hospitals to do something that works. Right now, we can't make hospitals produce particular outcomes with respect to their community health investments because we don't know what works.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And I really like the idea of reframing this almost as encouraging pilot programs or encouraging a diversity and pluralism among approaches to health here. And it, the way that you're framing it, Mary, actually is this interesting reversal of a narrative that I heard last year in terms of critiques of hospital rankings. So there was this article in Health Affairs in March 2015 that said essentially the four major ways of ranking hospitals, I think it was U.S. News, and there was a Consumer Reports, and there was a couple other ways of ranking and rating hospitals. They complained that essentially these ways of ranking and rating did not result in the same hospitals being in the top 10% or top quartile or something like that. And then when I followed up and I looked at, you know, the methodology for the U.S. News ranking of hospitals, it's astonishing. It's like a 120-page document laying out all these different efforts at risk adjustments and other things. And I think given the noted difficulties of risk adjustment and some other issues in terms of the metrics in healthcare, it makes a lot of sense to have a more open attitude and hope that there might be some really extraordinary things that come out of this, and also to accept the fact that there might be some bad ones. You know, there might be some things that we find out or just don't work that very well. So I think that spirit of openness is a great way to start the new year.
And I would just note, to circle back to a question you raised earlier, Frank, I think the other thing that we want to encourage hospitals to do is to encourage them to think broadly about community health needs, but also to think about how community health needs interlock with quality issues and interlock with disparities as well, because they're all part of the same cloth in my mind. And so thinking about disparities, certainly as on the one hand a civil rights issue, but on the other hand at the same time as a quality issue, also helps, I think, as we try to think about how the IRS or CMS can provide guidance to the hospitals that are trying in good faith, not to mention the ones that are simply gaming the system, but the ones that are trying in good faith to carry out these new requirements, that it may feel to the hospitals less like a scattershot approach of we have to do all of these different things at once. And instead, it actually can be part of the core value of community health improvement, which includes addressing disparities, which includes addressing quality issues, which includes addressing social determinants of health.
In the last couple of minutes that we can call on your time, Mary, one piece of yours recently that really did interest me even more going down this road. I'm obviously used to, you know, tying at readmissions and underinsurance and social determinants and the triple aim and so on into this space. But in a recent piece, you also weaved in medico-legal partnerships, which sort of brought things a little back to home to us, right? And I thought that was very interesting. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Right. This is a project that actually grew out of the Robert Wood Johnson Faculty Fellowship Program in Public Health Law that I worked on, because I was working with Jennifer Herbst from Quinnipiac and Liz Tobin Tyler from Brown. And we were all interested in different pieces of the CHINA process. I was interested in kind of the regulatory and what it requires of hospital. Liz Tobin Tyler is, of course, an expert on medical legal partnerships. And Jennifer Herbst had been working on actually doing community needs assessment with respect to legal needs. And as we put our heads together, it became increasingly clear that it's not a big step at all to view unmet legal needs as a social determinant of health, so that it could be perfectly appropriate for a hospital that is doing a community health needs assessment to consider as one of the implementation strategies that it adopts, one of those strategies might be participation in a medical legal partnership that would bring to bear the work of whether it's legal aid attorneys, law students, to address some of the unmet legal needs that its patients and others in the community are experiencing and may be detracting from their health.
And with that, I just wanted to tie in the commentary on medical legal partnerships to a note for listeners who might be going to the American Association of Law Schools conference in New York this weekend. There's actually a big panel put on, I believe, by Blake Morant at George Washington on medical legal partnerships with some folks from the public health school, I think Teitelbaum there. And of course, there's lots of great health law programming, including some several past guests of the show. So I'll be there at many of the health law events this weekend, and I hope to see some of the show's listeners too.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. Very special thank you to Professor Crossley for joining us today. Great fun having you with us, Mary.
It was a real pleasure to be with you both. Thank you.
We post our show notes at twill.com. If you have a moment, please go to iTunes and rate the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be reached this week?
I am at HealthPI for Health Privacy and Innovation on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.